Chapter 2, High Above Hollywood and Vine, Swami Prabhavananda. I am in Hollywood, but I am not of Hollywood, Swami Prabhavananda said many times. The first time I heard it, we were sitting in the greenhouse. That's the oldest portion of the center, which had been the home of Sister Lolita. Sister was Mrs. Carrie Wyckoff, one of the three Mead sisters, hosts and helpers of Swami Vivekananda in 1900. Sometimes one wondered if Swami Prabhavananda were even of this world. His immersion in elsewhere was of longer duration and more evident than in most persons of spiritual eminence. It was simply that he had practiced being absorbed in God until it had become natural, spontaneous. In those days, there were streetcar tracks through streets of Los Angeles and huge red cars that clanged along them. After meeting Swami Yatishvarananda, but before joining the Ramakrishna Order in San Francisco, I had made arrangements by mail for an interview early in 1945, possibly for 3 p.m. Somehow I found my way to that picture postcard Indian temple on the hill, a white gem of a Taj Mahal in miniature. Early for the appointment, I was asked to wait on one of the folding chairs which filled the sanctuary. Things were happening on the platform in front of me. Here was an American girl dressed in a full flowing Indian print, about to enter the sanctum sanctorum, a recess upholstered in gold fabric and featuring an oriental hardwood shrine which held familiar framed pictures. Sri Ramakrishna, the Holy Mother, Swami Vivekananda, and Brahmananda, and more. The girl bore the vase of flowers in her hands like some Minerva, and what with the aroma of incense pervading the hall, I had a distinct impression of the exotic. My first acquaintance with Vedanta had been among the sedate Philadelphians who were getting accustomed to Swami Yatishvarananda. Crossing the country and stopping for a few hours to meet the Chicago Swami in his apartment, I gradually realized the great variety that characterized this movement. Different places, different faces. So when a door on my left opened and a slight figure of a man with a good shock of hair and a complexion which could best be called a warm gray fairly floated across the dais and opened a door on the right of the shrine room, I thought it must be the Swami. Swami Prabhavananda now called me into his interview room office. What first struck me was the remarkable physical beauty of the man. No feminine quality is implied, but beauty is the only word sufficient to convey the air of grace, lithe elegance, and charm that he exuded. I always felt this way about him. Through the years I lived in his company, he was a delight to look at. To watch him move, laugh, frown, and especially perform worship was in each case a profoundly rewarding experience. But on that first afternoon, initial attraction gave way to dismay and embarrassment. Why? because I had to do all the talking. After introducing myself as a friend of the Swami in Philadelphia, who was a beloved monastic brother of his, and now back in California to see my relatives, I sat back to await the usual pleasantries. Inquiry of my Swami's health, my background, and so on. Nothing. Silence. I managed to produce questions about the Holodud Monastery. I knew he had started it. A statement of my intention to visit Gerald Hurd's place, Trabuco College, where I had some connections. Was not Hurd his student? Yes. Wasn't Trabuco Canyon a beautiful place? Yes, it was. Swami Prabhavananda evidently spoke mostly in monosyllables. He seemed to know everything in advance. One question I remember I asked, can there be in spiritual transformation a change of consciousness without a previous change in conduct and character? No, the Swami said, it was impossible. More silence. It was beginning to get quite warm in that little room. This was not quite what I had expected. When his replies were so brief, I would look at him in surprise. From that handsome, impassive face, the eyes would stare back at me with the blandness almost Chinese, and the discomfort was mine. It was a stare down. Now there was not much left but to pull out some faltering courtesies of farewell and excuse myself. Looking back at the twin rows of Italian cypress framing the approach to the temple, I walked down the hill. As I rode back in the clattering old streetcar, something physical happened. My throat was seized by an overwhelming, almost choking tickle. The sensation went on and on, as if it were going to bore right through my neck. And as I remember it, the one thought that came to me was something like this: that is one powerful Swami. The encounter was working on my ego without my knowing it. I've just met a tool in the hand of God. The strange part of it was that I had gone into the interview with a prejudice, for someone had told me that this Swami was a chain smoker. How could he then be enlightened, I had thought, and hence the question about consciousness and conduct. However, no cigarettes had appeared at the interview. Not knowing what to expect, and failing also to understand what I had found, I can only regard this introduction to the Swami as abortive. I did not see Swami Prabhavananda for the next 4 years. There had followed first a fascinating 2-week trial period at Trabuco College, an experimental foundation whose history must someday be written. By the end of it, I had listened, engrossed, to its founder, one of the most brilliant and learned men of the day, Gerald Hurd. And I had decided that he was not yet an illumined teacher. I had met the European woman who had become Sister Dhammadinna, Buddhist nun from Sri Lanka, one of my life's most unforgettable characters. And I had gleaned the gossip from the spiritual field about Huxley, Krishnamurti, Yogananda, the Ramakrishna Swamis, and so on. Then I had made my way up to San Francisco, and in the Vedanta Society of Northern California, began the first chapter of my monastic life. See chapter 3. It was much later, in September of 1949, the college property having been purchased by the Southern California Society for use as a monastery, that I returned to Tribhuvan at the suggestion of Swami Yatishvarananda. Swami Prabhavananda had written a letter accepting me and mentioning that he might be in India when I arrived, but not to mind, Swami Asheshananda would look after us well, and on his return we would meet. Arriving in Hollywood, I was just in time to see the figure of Tantin, Miss Josephine McLeod, lying in her coffin before the lid was closed. She had passed away a day or two before, and Swami Asheshananda was performing her funeral. Past 90, this famous friend of Vivekananda had ended her days living in the house of the Lord. My life at Tribhuvan Canyon, where Swami Asheshananda now joined with the five other men in launching the new monastery, will be dealt with in due course. But since the story I've embarked upon is about six particular Swamis I have known, and since life at Tribhuvan, in any case, was punctuated by trips into town, that is, to the Hollywood Center, where one would go for special occasions, on an errand, or for a change of pace, staying for a day or a week, I will resume my account of Swami Prabhavananda, where he might be seen at his most typical, in the Hollywood Center, his home since 1930. Part 1. Complex Environment, Simple Man. Look to the left of the White Temple, and behind it, and you see the domestic house of the center. In its kitchen we cooked, and in its dining room we all ate together, old and young, women and men. Swami called us his family, his monastic family. He wanted us to feel that way about it too. One is tempted to say this was a principle with him, expressed in his method of teaching. But did he actually have a method of training? Isn't it rather that soul consciousness, replacing body and gender consciousness, deep at the heart of his philosophy and his realization? And wasn't the way he conducted his center just the natural consequence of this? This family mentality gave birth to one of the choice stories in the center's history. An older devotee, a woman who often came on Saturday to help in the cleaning, was on her way one day trudging up the steep hill when she fell into conversation with a woman with a heavy shopping bag making the same trek. This proved to be one of the housekeepers of the neighborhood, who confided to our friend that she worked for a minister with three children. The devotee responded cheerily, "Well, I'm on the way to work for our minister myself." "Is that so? And how many children does he have?" Making a quick mental head count and remembering another about to join, the devotee replied, 8, and a ninth is on the way." The shopping bag hit the pavement as the housekeeper stopped dead in her tracks. And him a minister. Swami Prabhavananda's ground floor room lay farther back in this same building with a separate entrance. It was ample and gracious, with windows on three sides. The main elements, his bed, desk, and overstuffed chair. It was there that the family gathered on most evenings. After the supper had been cleared away, and if there was no public class that night, one by one the residents would quietly slip into the room and sit on the carpet around the big chair. What would Swami's mood be tonight? Difficult to predict. Sometimes he would be light-hearted, animated, full of fun. Often the evening would go in chit-chat about seemingly trivial matters, plans for festivities, garden or household problems, taxes and properties. The society owned an orange grove. Something bordering on gossip, regarding new devotees or old. At other times, Swami could be serious, silent, or extremely withdrawn. The atmosphere so lofty, one hardly dared even to think. The boys sat in one group, and the girls in another. This afforded opportunities for teasing. One Brahmacharini, that's a female novice, in particular, was forever being scolded for sitting too close to the boys. Of course, she was one about whom no one entertained any suspicions. It was an old trick of India. It was called scolding the daughter to teach the daughter-in-law. One was reminded of the scenes in the life of Swami Brahmananda in which the great disciple of Sri Ramakrishna and Prabhavananda's guru would chat away about all sorts of things not religious and yet leave indelible effects on all those around him. Then too, Swami Prabhavananda might at any moment in all this palaver enunciate some spiritual principle which would hush everything. Scolding was not the purpose of these sessions, but if it came up, so be it. I well recall the night when he was explaining something to me which seemed elementary, and I was so brash as to say, "Oh, I know all about that." He pulled me up abruptly. "Never say that you know all about something. That is not a good sign. Thakur, Sri Ramakrishna, said, so long as I live, I learn." Often he would teasingly play off the men against the women, as if, understanding the human tensions that naturally arose, he might somehow neutralize them by an airing in his own presence. Did the technique work? Most of the time. How did we feel about all this? For some, it was surely the high point of their day. Others were easily embarrassed. Some men who described themselves as allergic to women's chatter rather dreaded it. And those who could not profit by such freedom and exposure would not stay long in the residence. It was not exactly compulsory to come to Swami's room, but otherwise one felt left out. It was part of that peer pressure or family pressure of which we shall have more to say in other contexts. Certainly for most of his students, such opportunities were never to be missed. In the midst of it all, one senior brahmachari would be furiously scratching out on a notebook every word of Swami's, until tape recorders became available, and even after, or snapping at a parent random with his insatiable candid camera. He had his own good reasons. Occasionally such sessions could be true discourses or discussions, covering erudite or esoteric spiritual topics, proceeding step by step and poking the honeycomb, as they call it, the traditional Indian expression for drawing out spiritual wisdom and experience from the teacher. I happen to note down only one such conversation, but it is practically verbatim and may reveal to the reader something of the Swami's mind and demeanor. Swami, we are Jivakotis, ordinary souls. Question: can a Jivakoti get a glimpse of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the consciousness in which all duality, world, and otherness vanish, and Atman alone abides? Swami: no. Well, yes, but then they die. Within 21 days they die. Not that they have to live 21 days, but that is the maximum. But these cases are very few. Question: are they continually in the samadhi while the body is lasting in those days? Swami: I don't know. Smiling. Swami Asheshananda pipes up: is it not because they don't care to take care of the body at that time that they die? Swami: not merely that, Swami. You see, they find the bliss so great, they cannot bear to return to this plane. Only incarnations and Ishwarakotis, souls with spiritual qualities, special spiritual qualities, who come to earth, usually with a divine incarnation, and show some of their characteristics, can return from the Nirvikalpa. With Sri Ramakrishna came only 6 Ishwarakotis. But by his grace, other disciples became Ishwarakotis, as Swami Sivananda tells us himself. So it is something that other souls who do not begin as such can become. Question: then did all of his monastic disciples become Ishwarakotis? Swami: I cannot vouch for that. Probably more than one did. Question: could any of us, so long after, become Ishwarakotis? Swami: I don't think so. I don't want to limit, so I'll not say it could not be, but it's not likely. Sabikalpa Samadhi, in which a slight distinction remains between the individual and the universal, also makes one free, a Jivan Mukta, one who has been freed from ignorance, karma, and so on, even before death. Question: is it possible for a person who's had Sabikalpa Samadhi to return to a life in the world and even have children? Swami: not as a general rule, but there are many such cases. Look at the ancient rishis. Question: but did they have children after realization? Swami: apparently some did. Then there is prarabdha karma, that portion of karma which has already begun to be reaped in one's life, even if one is a jivanukta, which causes many strange things to happen which are inexplicable from the ordinary standpoint. Question: what about after nirvikalpa? Is it possible then? Swami: well, I don't know. We have the case of Totapuri. Not that he lived a worldly life, but he lived. Isn't that a wonder in itself? You see, he lived on simply because he had to teach Sri Ramakrishna. He had that mission. It is not that those whose prarabdha makes them temporarily overcome by bad tendencies are affected by those events. They are not. They are making no new karma thereby, just unwinding the old. Think of Swami Abhedananda. Such a great yogi, an illumined soul, and all that, yet he knew that jealousy was the bane of his life. It nearly took him out of the order, and he never did entirely overcome it. Question: can Ishvara Kotis then get involved in worldly life? Swami: there is the case of Purna, one of the remarkable young men who came to Sri Ramakrishna. His family forced him to marry and raise a family. The master counted him among his Ishvara Kotis. But don't ask me, I'm not an Ishvara Koti. Thakur showed us that there is a state higher even than Nirvikalpa, that which has all along been thought to be the highest. And Maharaj said that spiritual life begins with Nirvikalpa. Question: and yet none of us can hope to have Nirvikalpa in this life, not being Ishvara Kotis. Swami: ah, but you also can become Ishvara Kotis. You can get to that realm. After a time, he added, prarabdha karma is a term which is used more for things like marriage, where there is an element of choice involved. Especially is it true that the luminous souls can choose or avoid a thing like marriage to a large extent. They are not bound by such acts. End of quote. Odd, our little fledgling minds popping up with questions like these, remote from their immediate needs. Lovely, his unpompous patience to enter into the spirit of it all. It may have pleased him, too, just to know that he had succeeded in engaging these young minds in such intricate spiritual questions. One evening, a novice asked, pleasure, they say, is attended by pain. Does that mean vice versa also? Swami: no, pain is just pain, and pleasure becomes pain. The sense of relief when pain ends cannot be called pleasure. We are speaking of worldly experiences now, not spiritual ones. Somebody wanted to know, how can we yearn for that which is quite beyond our imagination, that is, God? His reply was subtle. It is not exactly beyond our imagination. We have some idea of that by seeing what we don't want, these things. Dispassion gives us the knowledge of God in a negative way, though we may not be able to imagine him positively. We can get an idea of what liberation would mean by examining our bondages. As one can see, these sessions were apertures for poking through to some of the finer points of the teachings. The peculiar condition of Sri Ramakrishna, called bhavamukha, a state of spiritual awareness between the relative and the absolute, was brought up on one occasion. Sri Ramakrishna said that when he had wanted to merge in the Absolute, Divine Mother had told him to stay in this condition. Quote, it was a condition between Savikalpa and Nirvikalpa, you can say. He was the observer of both these kinds of samadhi. Put another way, he was God, personal, and he was Brahman. So both of these together is just what he was. Naturally, his mind could alternate between them. He had savikalpa on his left hand and nirvikalpa on his right, so to speak, whereas others, jivas, come down from samadhi to normal consciousness. He came to this bhavamukha instead, being both Ishvara and Brahman. Swami had beautiful hands. The fingers were long and extremely graceful and somehow seemed to dangle from the palm. He was double-jointed and would amuse us by bending his fingers back with loud cracks. With the same gratefulness with which he performed the puja, or formal worship, he would do such mundane acts as the smoking of a cigarette. Under doctor's advice, he later gave up smoking. Catty remarks would inevitably come out in these family gatherings, but Swami never whitewashed anything. If other people's foibles were pointed out to him, more often than not, he would bend his head a little to one side, an Indian affirmative, and laugh or chuckle it off. I learned to appreciate this way of his. Formal teaching was given to the public and to us in the Sunday services at 11 o'clock in the morning and the two weekly evening classes. Since in my time, Swami Prabhavananda always had an assistant, one of these classes was assigned to the latter, and the Swamis would alternate on Sundays, with Gerald Hurd often taking a turn. He was paid for this and had a following of his own, which helped to swell the attendance and contributions. On one morning I listened, duly impressed, as Aldous Huxley took the pulpit. He was uncomfortable as a public speaker, but held one easily in his spell. Swami had a preference for one-word subjects: peace, joy, wisdom, renunciation. In any case, short topics. No matter what the title is, someone first summed it up, it all comes out God, an observation echoed forever after. Like their titles, the lectures themselves were simple and ended on the hour. Of course, I refer to the language and style. Nothing simple about Vedanta, one may say, yet here was the loftiest philosophy presented in easy and common terms. Like most of the Swamis, he used stories and jokes with great aplomb. Almost always when he spoke, there was a hushed atmosphere, it seemed. It seemed as if his listeners were feeling more like meditating than anything else. Swami Prabhavananda was never one to plead political or social concerns, rarely even ethical ones. It was mysticism, the lives of the holy, what the scriptures said, the principles and their practical application in the individual's life. With the scripture classes, he was never academic or unnecessarily erudite in Sanskrit, but rather he attempted to place each point in a setting the Western student could appreciate and identify with. He tried to see and frame an idea as he thought it would look in our eyes, and of course his long background in American life, particularly California, made this possible. Swami also could land a punch, using his abundant humor with devastating effect. Is sarcastic too strong a word? Let the reader find his own term to apply in the following incident. In the public class, Swami had given a thorough airing to his favorite theme, that the best and easiest way to realize God is to keep the divine thought going constantly in the mind. Now the question period was in progress. One lady ebulliently said, "But Swami, what if I am already thinking about God all the time? What do I do then?" "Madam," came the cool, measured tones, "if you can think of God constantly, you are either a fool or an illumined soul. And I know you are not an illumined soul." The air was electric. It was truly difficult for some to make anything of this quiet little man who could smilingly drop such depth charges, and who harped on God as if he were someone daily passing in and out of the house. Someone was once heard to complain after a lecture, "Why does he talk about God so much? To me, it sounds almost obscene." Sometimes, in attempts to explain how Vedanta has flourished in California, we credit the coastal location, or the physical and mental climates, or the cosmopolitan origin of the populace. More than these, surely, was the personal determination of Swami Prabhavananda and Swami Ashokananda, head of the Vedanta Society of Northern California, to put India behind them, in a sense, to try to feel themselves Western and American in order better to identify with us. They saw, as we said, through our eyes. They accepted the students as Westerners, rooted in American values, customs, and culture, destined to remain Western, and so encouraged them to feed their spiritual life from these nutritive capillaries. Their own self-adaptation replaced, through their surpassing humility, attempts to Indianize the students. One of the better illustrations is in the way they dressed. Both generally wore Western clothes. Swami Prabhavananda, however, was the only one of our Indian Swamis in the United States at that time who wore the Indian sannyasin's robes for the sacred functions, discourses, as well as meditation and puja. For 30 years, while all the other heads of centers used the long cloak adopted by Swami Vivekananda, Swami, dubbing it the bathrobe, rejected it for the original dhoti and chadar, and requested his assistants to do the same. On most other occasions, his clothes were quite informal. He preferred sweaters to jackets and wore casual slacks. There was a washable light blue pair that he wore for years. When I think of him at Tribuco, I always picture him that way, with his enormously broad-brimmed sun hat in summer, a cap in winter. He always looked ready to pitch in and help us with the manual work at any moment, and sometimes he did. His unabashed patriotism I found charming. It was not of the my government right or wrong type, but a childlike pride in being a citizen, an American in name as well as in spirit. Since he had arrived in this country before the new immigration restrictions of 1924, he eagerly took the opportunity to apply for citizenship and became the only citizen among our Indian Swamis. In the early days, he often recounted with glee how he had studied the manual and taken the oath, having passed the test handily. Did he ever vote? Indeed, he did. He favored our using the English language for chants and songs, retaining, however, the traditional Sanskrit Vesper service used throughout the world. Even for these hymns, he wanted translations made. He made no particular effort to encourage the study of Sanskrit. We had, he thought, more important things to do. Living around Swami, one always felt that every moment must somehow be employed in the direct pursuit of the one goal of life, realizing God here and now. Maharaj had promised this was possible and not at all difficult. Did we doubt him? Did we really want to make scholarly and egoistic detours? Already I had a habit of Sanskrit study and so could not so much appreciate the fact that the monastics were not learning it. On the other hand, this bent of mine, Swami never discouraged or hindered. One might suppose that with his penchant for the use of English in liturgy, he would have made a translation of the daily puja ritual. Perhaps because he had a most reverential attitude toward it, not teaching it, for instance, to non-initiates, and conducting it in silence, he may have thought it too sacrosanct for a public translation. Rather, he made an outline, part explanation, part translation, for the use of those being trained in it. He chanted in Sanskrit every morning in the shrine room at the close of meditation, choosing from some dozen brief stanzas. I do not know to this day how musical they were, for to my ear the pitch seemed to wander when he sang alone, but they were something to look forward to. If Swami Prabhavananda seemed unusually proud of the Hollywood Center and inclined to be articulate in asserting its merits, one should realize that this was nothing uncommon in the pioneer Swamis during these first years while their work became established. It was a way of inspiring people new to Vedanta whose underpinnings were shaky through doubt and the alien quality of Oriental things. Like others, he boosted his own, and Swami Prabhupada, being an original, had to fend off the jibes not only of the uninformed public, but of well-meaning brother monks as well. Then there was the Northern California versus Southern California rivalry. Like the two regions, football teams, universities, politics, climate, and water rights, Vedanta had to share in the feints and fortunes of a long-standing geographical partisanship. The bees had to be kept in and around the hive, prevented from losing their way too far afield. Devotees at every center were encouraged to think of their Swami as the best and his ways of teaching and training superior. Spiritually, this was life-preserving, one supposed, but one could also suppose it would one day have to be outgrown. If they were at opposite poles on some matters of method and emphasis, there was one issue which brought Ashokananda and Prabhavananda onto common ground, and that was the lack of understanding at Bedouramat of the special requirements of the Western work. About the women, most of all, and the status of the convent. For at this time, a parallel order for women had not yet become a reality in India. Swami wrote to me from Santa Barbara in 1967, quote, "The Swamis, even those who are in authority, have no idea of our work in the West. So the present authorities try to create trouble for us. Prabhu Maharaj, Swami Vireshwarananda, Shuddhji Maharaj, Swami Nirvanananda, and the older ones are different. For the past year, both Yogesh Maharaj, that's Swami Ashokananda, and I had to pass through many heartaches because of the ignorance of some of the authorities. At long last, things have been straightened out.